That Halloween, Varmint stood in the doorway like a sweet child, luring trick-or-treaters in with his innocent smile. He enjoyed being the bait. As they walked up the path, they passed my flash powder-filled holes. Each hole was wired to an extension cord that led to my room, from which I watched the whole spectacle. When the kids got close, I would plug in a cord, detonating the powder in one of my holes. There would be a hell of a flash and a roar. A fireball would rise into the sky, and dirt would fly everywhere. The kids would scream and scatter. That year was one of our most economical candy years. Very few trick-or-treaters braved the blasts for a second run. We ate the candy ourselves the next day. As I got older, my practical jokes grew more sophisticated. When I was 14, my guidance counselor said, "John, some of your tricks are sick. They are evil. They indicate deep-seated emotional problems." It was true that some of my pranks had taken on a nasty edge. My sadness at how other kids had treated me all my life had turned to anger. If I had not found electronics and music, I might well have come to a bad end. It was around this time that I came up with one prank that trumped all the others. It was one hot summer night in the Shutesbury Woods when the rural quiet ended abruptly. Everyone in my house was asleep as I opened my bedroom window and dropped to the ground. I carried a knife and a flashlight, though I didn't expect I'd need either one unless something went very wrong. I knew my way, and I was prepared. I walked up the dirt road, ducking into the bushes any time the lights of a car approached. It was about a mile from my house to my destination, the power lines on Sand Hill Road. Underneath the steel high-tension tower, 100 yards back from the road, 5 1-gallon cans of paint were arranged in a pentagram. I'd carefully swept the area clear of leaves and debris, and I'd cut straight pieces of wood from the trees nearby for the lines of the pentagram. The cans marked the points. There was a 5-gallon pail of roofing tar in the middle, with a circle of stones around it. I had set them out that afternoon, and now I lit them. With all of them burning, thick and poisonous black smoke rose in a cloud that blotted out the stars above. I had hoped the paints, oil-based stains, actually, would burn in different colors, but they all burned with the same dull yellow flames. I had stolen the paint cans from a construction site down the road, and I hadn't had time to test burn them. I wished I had some kerosene, too, to liven things up. Maybe even some gasoline. But it was too late for that. The paint would have to do. It was a moonless night, and the rising smoke made it even darker up in the tower. But the fires would be burning brighter soon, and then I knew my guests would be able to see. My guests, of course, had not yet arrived. I had set up the whole scene in the dark. It had been hard work, especially climbing the tower. It was scary being up there with 75,000 volts only a few feet above my head. A quick move up there might have been fatal. I felt the electricity crackle once when I raised my arm, and I slowly and carefully lowered it back down. Rigging the rope was the hardest part. It was a heavy pull for a 14-year-old. But I did it. No one saw me. By 11 o'clock, there was no traffic at all. I hadn't seen a car pass in over an hour. I was ready. The fires were brighter, and anyone approaching would be sure to see what I'd done. About 10 feet above the pentagram, a body was hanging. It was dressed in old clothes, and the rope around its neck was tied to the crosstree of the electric tower, 30 feet above. I had practiced making hangman's nooses until I got it right. The one up on the tower was perfect, as anyone with a flashlight could see. The feet had already turned black and greasy from the smoke, and the blackness was trailing up the legs. Soon the whole body would be covered in disgusting, oily black soot. The tar in the middle was bubbling now. The edges of the pots glowed dull red. I'd adjusted the body's height carefully, too high to recover from the ground, but low enough to see in the light of the fires. Overall, I was pleased. Out at the road, a few 100 yards away, the fires were visible as a dim glow through the brush, not bright enough to attract attention. College students had campfires and all-night parties up there every weekend when school was in session. But school wasn't in session, and this was no college party. It was time to call the authorities. I walked out to the road. It was pitch black. There were no houses for a half a mile in either direction, and no streetlights. Just a lonely dirt road. The only people within shouting distance were the dead ones in the cemetery down near the stream. I climbed the telephone pole on the street and clipped on the wires from my linesman's telephone, which I had looted along with some other supplies from a visiting phone truck a few months earlier. I clipped onto the phone circuit for Mr. Ellis, one of my least favorite neighbors. Out there, the phone circuits ran on individual pieces of copper wire strung from pole to pole. Our town had 273 residents, as of the last census, and they didn't all have phones. If you're going to climb poles and clip onto wires in the dark, you need to know which ones carry phone signals and which carry electrical power. Otherwise, you can get fried. I had a dial tone, hanging from the pole by a strap made from two belts I'd stolen from my father. I dialed the state police, whose number I had memorized.
"State police, this line is being recorded," the trooper said.
"I'd like to report a hanging," I said in my lowest and toughest voice.
"What?"
That slowed him down.
"A ritual hanging. A person on Sand Hill Road from the power lines. Come see."
I unclipped the phone, climbed down, and retreated into the woods. "If they can trace the call," I said to myself, "that jerk Ellis will get a visit tonight. He had a kid, too, a snotty little shit. Maybe they'll wake him up and ask him about this," I thought. "Maybe they'll even arrest him." I snickered at the thought. I circled back through the stream in case the visiting police had dogs. I felt at home in the woods after dark. My night vision was excellent, my hearing superb. I worked my way into a perch in a pine tree. From there I had a panoramic view of the whole scene, but I was far enough back in the trees that I was invisible, even if they shined lights. I could climb down silently, and I was high enough that casual searchers would pass under me if I needed to hide. I waited in the dark. I used to be afraid of the dark, but I wasn't anymore. I used to fear barking dogs. I would cringe and say to myself, "Nice doggy, please don't bite me, I'll just go away." But by that night, I could look at them and think, "I am your worst nightmare. Come closer, and I will impale you upon my stick." The more firmly I visualized it, the more the dogs believed it. Now the tables had turned. Now the dogs feared me. 15 minutes passed. Perhaps the police were far away. Perhaps they were napping. Finally, I saw headlights approaching. They had arrived. The wait was over. The police car stopped in the road. The door opened and closed. There was only one trooper in the car. State troopers usually patrolled alone back then. I knew my fire would draw him in, like a moth to a flame. There was nothing else for him to see. There was only one power line, and my fire was the only light. It was burning even brighter now. The flickering light illuminated him as he walked on the path to the tower. He had his light in his hand. He aimed it up a bit. Above the fire, the body twisted gently in the smoke. The trooper stopped dead in his tracks.
"Holy shit!" I heard him say.
He looked around, swinging his flashlight back and forth, searching for an attacker in the brush. He drew his gun, but there was nothing to shoot. In the movies, this was the moment when something big and black grabbed the trooper and dragged him screaming into the swamp. From the look of him, I was sure he'd seen those movies too. I was very still, not wanting to be shot. There was no sound other than the chirps and creaks of the nighttime and the occasional rustle of wind in the trees. He jumped and spun every time the trees rustled. There was no light except the flicker of the fires and the headlamps of the cruiser up on the road. Suddenly, he holstered his gun, turned, and ran back to his cruiser. I heard the door open and shut. I heard the click as he locked the doors. The blue light started flashing. He remained in his vehicle. I wasn't surprised. If I were him, all alone out there, I'd stay in my car, too, after seeing that. Police are supposed to be brave, but there are limits. I heard the chatter on his radio, but I could not make it out. I figured reinforcements were being called. 10 minutes passed. The fire got brighter. 2 more cruisers arrived. They all got out of their cars. They talked. Everyone knows there is safety in numbers. Now they were brave.
Where is he?
The first trooper led the way. They walked down the power line road to the tower. They looked up.
Son of a bitch,
one of the new troopers said.
What do we do?
You climb up and cut him down.
I'm not getting fucking electrocuted. He ain't going nowhere. He's dead.
Call the fire department.
Call the electric company.
They shined lights around, looking for perpetrators. One trooper returned to his cruiser, presumably to call the fire department and the power company. When he returned, he had the pump shotgun from his trunk. I'm sure it was loaded. But there was nothing to shoot. There's no ambush tonight. It was still quiet. More time passed. I was getting bored up in my tree. They did not interfere with my burning pentagram. I wondered what they made of it. Was it devil worship? A lynching? An elaborate suicide? By now the body was jet black from the soot, and it was starting to drip from the heat of the burning tar, which was bubbling in the pail. I was glad I had used tar. The drips and the foul black smoke kept the people back. The fire department arrived. First came a single fire truck, then individual firemen in a ragtag collection of vehicles. Soon half a dozen cars and pickups clustered in the road, with red lights flashing. The electric company crew arrived next, with a big yellow cherry picker truck. It had only taken one of me to hang my friend up in the tower, but it was going to take 20 of these people to get him down. Now we had blue, red, and yellow lights all flashing. The road was blocked. Radios were cackling. If we had been in the city, there would have been a crowd gathered by now. They finally decided to put the fire out, but they acted as though it might be booby-trapped. The firemen seemed afraid to go near the paint cans. I guess the scene was unusual enough to be unsettling. People continued shining flashlights into the grass around the tower, but there was no evidence to be found. I had made sure of that. I'd worn gloves, and all the materials had been scavenged or stolen. I hadn't bought anything that was up in the tower, and nothing was traceable to me. They couldn't get fingerprints off a tree, and they weren't going to catch me. There were no fire hydrants on Sand Hill Road, but the fire truck had a water tank on board. They unrolled a hose and walked in the direction of the tower. I wondered why they didn't just drive there. Perhaps they'd blocked themselves in with all the cars up at the road. From 50 feet back, the fireman turned the water on my fire. The hose jumped, and a blast of water hit the burning pots and scattered them. All of a sudden, there was a big cloud of steam and a flash. Burning paint and tar went flying. Now the grass was on fire, too. All those firemen standing around suddenly had something to do. For a moment, the body was forgotten. More hoses came out, and shovels, and foam, and soon the whole area was wet and dark. Firemen walked around in the dark, stomping out embers. It was hard to see the body now that the light had gone. One of the cops shined a light on it.
"Turn the fucking light off! Don't you have any respect?"
The power line had been turned off. I could tell, because the faint crackle from the wires had stopped. There was no sound but the crickets. The power company truck bumped down the road to the tower. The driver stopped at its base and put out his wheel chocks, just like he was on a highway. The ambulance followed him down, and they backed up to face the tower. Another power company truck lit the ground at the base of the tower with its headlights. The cherry picker on the first electric company truck started rising. The medics gathered at the base of the tower with a stretcher. It was time to recover the body.
"Ready down there?"
"Ready."
The lineman reached over and cut the rope. The body fell. The medics moved gingerly to pick it up. Suddenly there was a shout, and the reverent mood changed.
"Fuck!"
A few seconds later, I heard the disgusted yell,
"It's a fucking mannequin!"
A department store dummy. It's a fucking joke.
Smiling, I slipped out of my tree and into the woods. I headed for home quickly in case anyone came to check on me. I hid my lineman's phone and dark clothes in the cemetery on the way home. I climbed the board I had left leaning against the side of the house and crawled in through my bedroom window. Before I dropped inside, I kicked the board away and it fell among the high grass, car parts, and junk on the ground in front of the house. I slipped into bed and pretended to be asleep. Soon I was. I had always known that someday I would find a use for that mannequin I saw in the dumpster behind Mr. Walsh's clothing store. It had been hard getting him home and hiding him, but it had proved worth it. The next day, I returned to the power line to get the mannequin. He was gone. I figured the police had taken him. There was no sign of the previous night's excitement, except a burned spot in the grass near the tower and some empty, charred paint cans on the ground. The tar had soaked into the dirt in the middle of the stones, and my sticks were scattered about. I wished I could tell someone about my adventure. I had few friends, and I couldn't tell my brother, because he was only 6 and had no sense. He would probably rat me out to some other little animal's mother. I didn't say anything about the incident to anyone for a long time. A few days later, my mother took me to the airport for my annual trip to visit my grandparents in Georgia. It was just as well that I'd be in Georgia in case the cops came around asking about the mannequin. Chapter 9. I Drop Out of High School. As my 16th birthday approached, I found myself spending less time in school and more time hanging around bars with local bands. I was failing every subject. Working with John and Fred in the AV department was the only activity that interested me. That and walking Little Bear home. My graduation date seemed to recede 2 days into the future with every day that passed. My parents seemed oblivious to my struggles. After all, they were starring in their own epic, and I was just a supporting player. At this point in their marriage, my parents largely left Varmint and me alone. That allowed them to focus all their energies on attacking each other. Their fights would increase in intensity until something blew. On several occasions, that meant a quick departure for my mother, my brother, and me. "Your father has snapped," my mother declared on one of those occasions. "He's homicidal. He's planning to kill us all. We have to hide until the doctor can have him committed." I had heard my mother say that before, and indeed I would hear it several more times in the year to come. But I still wasn't sure who was telling the truth. She might have been right, I figured, given my previous experience with my father. In retrospect, though, I suspect it was merely my mother's paranoia, fueled by her mental illness and Dr. Finch's increasingly bizarre behavior. He renamed his office the Institute of Maturation, and on sunny days he paraded around town with an umbrella, towing a passel of balloons. He said he was drawing attention to his causes. At times, when my mother posed a difficult question, he would use a technique called Bible dipping to arrive at an answer. He'd say, "Margaret, open the Bible and put your finger on a passage." She would do that, and he would read the passage, and we'd discuss what to do. I don't mean to disparage the Bible, but frankly, it does not strike me as the place to look for answers to questions like, "Should we leave home and go stay in Gloucester for a while?" "I want a professional to tell me what to do," I thought. "I can go home and read the Bible some other time." It was hard to object to even his most dubious techniques, though, because he and his family were always really nice to me, and he made me feel better. After a few days' vacation, we returned home. While we were gone, the police had arrested my father and locked him in the Northampton State Hospital for observation. When they let him out a week or so later, he was subdued and seemed to have less potential for violence. I watched him carefully because of his prior history, but I had always judged the probability of his murdering us to be low. When he got drunk, he was mostly just belligerent, and I doubted he would actually hunt us down and kill us while sober. Also, thanks to his talks with the doctor, he no longer attacked me, no matter how much he might have wanted to. Dr. Finch was in some ways the least predictable variable in the whole equation. Sometimes it seemed like he calmed things down, and other times it seemed like he fired my parents up. Looking back, I can see that my father was seriously depressed. At the same time, my mother was becoming genuinely crazy. She would tell me about the demons that were watching her, interrupting herself periodically to howl like a wild animal. My brother has described it very well. She would get a glint in her eye, and she would become manic. She would talk non-stop and smoke non-stop and go faster and faster and faster and then surprise you by doing something totally outlandish, like eating cigarette butts in the middle of a conversation. Is it hereditary? I wondered. Will it happen to me? The terrifying threat of mental collapse followed me long into adulthood. My brother and I lurched from one parent to another, with my parents' friends and the doctor's daughter, Hope, popping in to take care of us when both parents were down for the count. My mother's friend, Pat Schneider, sticks in my mind as helping more than most in that time, but many other people whose names I have forgotten pitched in. I don't know what would have happened if they had not been around. I guess we'd have ended up in foster homes or something even worse. When the ambulance arrived to take my mother to the state hospital a few months after our vacation, I agreed with Dr. Finch that she needed to be there. I dimly remember going to visit her. We had to go through several locked doors, as in a prison, and my mother looked like an inmate. She seemed to be in a zombie-like state from whatever medication they had put her on. I wondered if she would ever get out. That was a very hard time for Varmint and me, because we didn't know whom to believe. It seemed like everyone told us a different story. "Your mother has temporarily lost her mind," our father would say when she wasn't around. "It runs in her family." That was said in a perfectly calm voice. And when she was gone, he didn't get drunk. Why can't he be that way all the time? I thought. Our mother, meanwhile, prepared us for the idea that our father was planning to hunt us down and kill us someday, at least until she herself was locked up. One of the toughest things about living with my parents was the way they changed at the drop of a hat. Some days my father would just lie in bed, mumbling nonsense like, "The bats are flying all around. I have to go get the sink." "He's just acting out," my mother would rage. Was he? I could never tell. The next day it would be as if nothing had happened. To my grandfather Jack, it seemed pretty black and white. "Your mother's family is just no damn good. All those Richters are crazy. Look at them." I did look at them, and they seemed okay to me. Jack's comments really worried me, though. For a long time, I wished I could move down to Georgia and live with Jack, but I never did. "Your parents are really good people, and they mean well. They're just having a hard time." Pat Schneider and Dr. Finch's daughter Hope would try to reassure us, but they were not the ones whose parents were raving or locked in cages. I tried to look out for Varmint, but it was hard. With all the chaos, there wasn't much chance of my being an A student ever again, or even passing my courses. I had too many family problems and too many defects. I've already mentioned my problems looking people in the eye. There were other issues, too. Apparently, I was also guilty of bobbing and bouncing and weaving, and the stress was making it worse. "Why are you bobbing your head like that?" I heard that line a lot from teachers and other grown-ups when I was little. I still hear a variation of it today. "Dad, stop being autistic." That's what my teenage son says when I rock back and forth in a restaurant. Both comments, snivels, I would call them, since no harm is being done, refer to my tendency to move in some kind of regular pattern without knowing it. I might be lying on the sofa, moving my foot back and forth. Or I might be reading a menu, gently rocking from side to side. Or I might just be bobbing my head up and down. Whatever I'm doing, it feels perfectly normal to me. But I guess normal people don't do it. I don't know what causes me to start. In fact, I seldom notice when I do start. It just happens. Then someone says, "Stop bobbing," and I come to a halt. "What's the matter with you? I told you about that head bobbing 5 minutes ago, and now you're doing it again. Are you trying to make me mad?" Reactions like that would just reinforce the feeling that I did not belong in school. Along with bobbing and weaving, I was also frequently criticized or ridiculed for inappropriate expressions. These attacks seemed to me to come out of the blue, and they usually made me want to run off and hide. "Why are you staring at me like that? Wipe that stupid expression off your face right now. You're scary. You're staring at me like a specimen in a jar." When I was in 10th grade, I heard the increasingly unwelcome specimen in a jar crack one time too often from my English teacher, Mrs. Crowley. "What are you staring at?" she would say. It was not a polite question, but a rude demand. So one day, I answered her rudeness with sweetness and light. "Oh, Mrs. Crowley," I answered in my nicest voice, "I was just imagining you chained up in a deep hole with a heavy steel grate on top, and rats, lots of rats, crawling all over you." Then I made a smile, baring my teeth the way dogs do when they're ready to bite. That got me a trip to the principal, and then the guidance office, and then the school psychologist. But it was worth it. Mrs. Crowley never once made a crack to me again. I don't recall any grown-up ever trying to figure out why I was staring. I might have been able to tell them if they had asked. Sometimes I was thinking of other things and just gazing their way absent-mindedly. Other times I was watching them intently, trying to interpret their behavior. My parents decided on a last-ditch effort to keep me in school. They enrolled me in a group for troubled kids. We would meet each week in an old farmhouse owned by the university and talk about our problems getting along. There were six of us, and a facilitator, who was a psychology major. They didn't teach me to get along, but I did learn that there were plenty of other kids who couldn't get along any better than me. That in itself was encouraging. I realized that I was not the bottom of the barrel, or if I was, the bottom was roomy because there were a lot of us down there. In the first 16 years of my life, my parents took me to at least a dozen so-called mental health professionals. Not one of them ever came close to figuring out what was wrong with me. In their defense, I will concede that Asperger's did not yet exist as a diagnosis, but autism did, and no one ever mentioned I might have any kind of autistic spectrum disorder. Autism was viewed by many as a much more extreme condition, one where kids never talked and could not take care of themselves. Rather than take a close and sympathetic look at me, it proved easier and less controversial for the professionals to say I was just lazy or angry or defiant. But none of those words led to a solution for my problems. It would take more than a discussion group to fix my school troubles. So when my next report card showed straight Fs, I realized it was time to go. There hadn't been much keeping me there anyway beyond the vague idea that being a legitimate high school graduate was better than being a dropout. There was only one problem. I was just 15, and it was against the law to quit school before the age of 16. The school had such a strong desire to be rid of me that they stepped up to the plate with a solution. "If you take the GED and score at least 75%, we'll treat you as a graduate and you can leave." My guidance counselor presented this to me in the same tone of voice he'd used to sell some punk a $200 Cadillac in his second job as a used car salesman. I took the test and got a 96%. They offered me a diploma for a small recording fee. "Only $20, the clerk said with a smile. I smiled back. "No thanks," I said. "I don't need your diploma." And I never looked back. My parents hardly seemed to notice. It was time to figure out what to do now that I was a 15-year-old grown-up. It was a little scary. I retreated to the woods to think, just as I'd done as a little boy in Seattle. I had always loved the outdoors, and once I wasn't in school, it felt as though I had all the time in the world. It was spring, and I spent a lot of time alone, thinking about what I should do next. I would venture out from home for days at a time, living under trees and in falling down cabins that I found in the forest. One day, I was walking through a glade of young pine trees several miles from home, when a voice boomed out of nowhere, "Stop right there!" I ducked under some pine branches. There shouldn't have been anyone for miles in any direction. But there was. 20 feet in front of me, a shaggy-haired guy in army camouflage sat tending a coffee pot over a small fire. What the fuck? I stopped. The guy was camped in the middle of a small clearing. I saw a green tent behind him. There were no guns in sight. There didn't seem to be anyone else around.
You're just a kid. What are you doing out here?
I didn't think of myself as just a kid, but he was older and bigger and appeared to be living in the woods. I considered running away, but there didn't seem to be any threat. I decided to answer.
I live here, I said, about 2 miles away. What are you doing here?
I live here too, he said. Right here.
Here in the woods?
Grown-ups were not supposed to live in tents.
For now.
I've lived in worse places, he said. Have a seat. I sat down and he began to talk. Paul told me he was a disabled Vietnam veteran. He had been shot and his leg didn't work very well anymore. After getting out of the service, he'd been hitchhiking around the country, living off the land. I was fascinated.
Want a drink? He asked.
I wasn't exactly sure what he was offering, but I nodded. He opened a small glass bottle filled with what looked like fizzy water. Canada Dry was all the label said. I took a sip and would have spit it out if I weren't on my best behavior.
What is it? I asked.
I knew whiskey was nasty to swallow, but that drinking it was a sign of being grown up. Maybe this stuff would be the same.
Quinine water.
He said it brightly, as though anyone should know what it was, and know it was good. By that point in my life, I had heard of all the most common types of liquor. Vodka, whiskey, rum, tequila, bourbon. None of them sounded anything like quinine water.
I acquired a taste for it in Nam, he said. It keeps you from getting malaria.
I had never heard of anyone in New England coming down with malaria. Maybe it's one of those rare diseases like meningitis, I thought. So it's like medicine water. I took another drink. I had read about how they had to conquer malaria in order to build the Panama Canal. I looked around as I sipped my quinine water, comparing the Shutesbury Woods to the Central American jungle. Paul was living in a glade far from roads, with nothing more than an army tent and a duffel bag. He had made a seat from a log, and he had a small ring of stones with a fire that warmed an old coffee pot. Where was his food?
I live off the land, and I forage in town, he told me.
Whatever he was doing must work, I figured, because he looked healthy.
Why don't you build a shelter? I asked.
I don't want to settle down, he said. I need to be able to move out on a moment's notice.
In fact, he never did build a shelter. He seemed impervious to weather. I had always thought I knew my way around the woods, but Paul showed me how much I still needed to learn. Paul could snare rabbits for stew. He caught trout for breakfast. And to round it out, he knew how to forage in dumpsters for fresh baked goods and vegetables. Until I met him, I never knew the bounty that could be fished from a dumpster in a town like ours. It was from Paul that I learned how to catch fish with a BB gun. It's surprisingly simple, provided you're a good shot. You sit at the edge of the pool, gun at the ready. Ideally, you sit in a tree branch so that you are 8 to 10 feet off the ground, looking down into the pool. Then you throw breadcrumbs onto the pond's surface. When the fish swim up to eat them, you shoot them. It's a lot easier than fishing, but it does take a steady hand.
I use a shotgun with slugs, Paul said. That way you don't have to hit the fish. They get stunned when the slug hits the water, and you just scoop them up. The only easier way to get fish is to toss a grenade in the pond and go in with a big net, he told me.
I soon heard he'd done that over at Smith College. The shore was lined with dead fish when I walked over to check it out. Thanks to Paul, I learned to walk silently through the woods. I learned to flow around and under the brush, so as to pass without a sound and without a trace. I learned to live in the woods, not just visit. I also learned to watch where I stepped.
Watch that wire!
Wire? Paul had rigged a perimeter of tripwires around his camp to prevent someone walking in and surprising him.
they were virtually invisible.
If that was rigged to a Claymore mine, you'd be dead now.
As a kid in the Shutesbury Woods, it never would have occurred to me to watch for tripwires and landmines. 30 years later, though, I still remember what he showed me, and I watch where I step. He told me stories of his time in the Army. I expected a Vietnam vet to tell me of combat in faraway places, but that wasn't what I heard. He told me about being ambushed by tigers in the jungle. He told me about loading bales of drugs and contraband aboard DC-3 airplanes. He told me of setting booby traps for the enemy and impaling them with sharpened sticks. His stories bore no resemblance to my previous notions of war, which were formed watching Vic Morrow in the TV series Combat. Paul stayed in his camp all through that summer. I walked up to visit him almost every day, and I stayed several days on many occasions. It was a nice place to pass the time. There was no family trouble, no pressure to get a job, and no one to give me a hard time. The skills that had enabled Paul to hide in the Asian jungle allowed him to remain perfectly hidden in Shutesbury. Whenever I was there, I was invisible too. It was nice living in the Shutesbury woods with my friend Paul, but any time I wanted to go to town, I faced a 6-mile walk. I never wanted to be a hermit. I always imagined myself being around other people, even though I had a hard time interacting with them. I realized that I needed some unique talent that would make people interact with me. That way I wouldn't have to initiate any interactions. I'd just have to respond, which was easier for me. Luckily, I was going somewhere with my talent for fixing and improving and innovating musical equipment. I seemed to be able to make it sing in a way that few others could. More and more, musicians began seeking me out. With every passing week, I was growing up. I had learned to avoid landmines and had started imagining a future for myself in music. That September, when the nights began getting cooler, Paul began talking about going south to Florida. One fall morning, I walked up to see him, and he was gone. No trace of him. The camp had been swept clear. I could have walked through a few days later, and I would never have known that someone had lived there for 2 months. No trash, no disturbed ground, no evidence of any kind. I never knew where he went, and I never told anyone about him or what he taught me. Years later, I saw a news story about Paul testifying at a Boston anti-war hearing and discovered that he was a war hero, a highly decorated Green Beret. It was time to come out of the woods and join society. Chapter 10. Collecting the Trash. For a long time, I had been considering how to escape my parents' house. When I was 15, my father had bought a motorcycle to commute to school. He wouldn't let me ride it, but it got me thinking about a bike of my own. I asked everyone I knew about motorcycles for sale. I scanned the classified ads for a cheap motorcycle. Finally, I found one. I bought a 1966 Honda Dream for $25. Once I made it run, I was able to get away, at least temporarily. It was with the possibility of escape in mind that I followed my parents to their friend Walter Henderson's 40th birthday party. My parents were always on their best behavior when they were out in public, so I knew they would not turn on me. And I would be downtown, where it would be easy to get away if things got strange. Slave and stupid seldom did anything together. However, they both liked the Hendersons, so they headed to Walter's birthday party together. I liked Walter, too, at least what I knew of him. He taught English at Amherst College and wore a brown corduroy jacket. He was always an interesting fellow to talk to, and he seemed moderately interested in me. For some reason, my parents really wanted me to go to his party. I had never gone to a faculty party before. They were for grown-ups, usually my parents' friends. Some of their friends were okay, but others seemed to me arrogant and conceited, and it was starting to make me angry. I knew I was some kind of misfit, but it was becoming apparent that some of the grown-ups who smiled sweetly and told me how terrible and fucked up I was were complete fuck-ups themselves. And my experience in the music scene had shown me that there were places in the world where misfits were welcome. Slave said, "John Elder, Walter and Annette really like you, They really hope you'll come to their party.
Maybe they like me, I thought. Or maybe they think I'll be entertaining because I'm weird. Yes, that was more likely. They thought I was weird. Stupid said,
It's up to you, son, but they did invite you. If you ignore invitations, pretty soon they stop coming in.
As if I ever got invited to parties. I decided to go. But I didn't ride with them. I went on my motorcycle. When we arrived, a big crowd was milling around in Walter's yard. They had a tent set up, and a table with food and what looked like a band. Everyone was dressed better than me. They probably all have good educations, respectable jobs, and families, I thought. But I figured, I'm clean, I shower every day, I'll be okay here. Walter had had cards printed for the occasion. He gave me one when we arrived. It said, Walter Henderson, 40. Lecturer, 40 different topics. Traveler, 40 different countries. Chef, 40 different courses. Lover, 40 different women. This was going to be my kind of party, I could already tell. I didn't know what to do, so I just stood there. Annette saw me and led me over to talk to one of her friends. I guess she meant well. After a brief introduction, she flitted off to take care of the next guest. Her friend George turned out to be a rather pompous professor who tried to engage me in conversation.
We have a son about your age, he told me. We're very proud of him. He's starting at Harvard in the fall.
Just then, another couple walked over, and the woman said,
Our daughter Janet has decided to go to Smith, so she'll be nearby for 4 more years. What are you doing?
All three of them looked at me. I wasn't doing anything in particular. I certainly wasn't going to Harvard. Somehow, I was in the improbable position of scoring in the 99th percentile on the intelligence tests and still flunking out of high school. I was sure this crowd would just sneer at the idea of my growing reputation with local bands, so I decided not to mention it.
I've actually started on a career, I said. Really? What are you doing?
This came from Thurston, another pompous friend of Annette's. Thurston, a department head at Amherst College, was far removed from making any career choices himself. He stood there, drink in hand, with a superior smile. Perhaps he was thinking of visiting his Thugwald, or whatever his son's name was, at Yale.
I've gotten into the waste management business, down in Springfield. They've started me right at the bottom so I can really learn the business. On a truck in the North End.
You mean you're a garbage collector? Someone asked, polite but incredulous. Garbage collectors were not usually seen at Amherst College faculty parties. Garbage collectors came in afterward and emptied the trash. They didn't participate in creating the trash with their intellectual betters. I smiled back.
We don't call ourselves garbage collectors. We are sanitary engineers.
By this time, another older fellow had stepped over to join the conversation. I didn't know him, but with his curly hair, tweed coat, and bow tie, he probably wasn't a sanitary engineer.
I'm an engineer. I went to college for 8 years for the privilege. I don't think a mere city garbage collector has the credentials to call himself an engineer.
I decided to change the subject. You know, we see all kinds of things. Just last week, one of my buddies found a dead baby in the dumpster behind one of the dorms at the college. That was met with shocked silence. We heard the mother was a student there. No one knows why she threw the baby away. Her father was the president of some big company. But she's in jail now. There were now 6 people gathered around. I had given them something to think about. Would their kids do anything like that? One of the moms forced a smile and said,
It must be hard being out there in all kinds of weather.
The weather isn't the problem. We can take weather. It's the packs of wild dogs and the feral children you really have to worry about.
Feral children?
That surprised them. We meet them in the rougher parts of town. 2 of them hit one of our guys in the head with a beer bottle full of gravel. Cut him badly. Almost killed him. They're worst when they're in packs. And some of them carry knives. My audience looked shocked.
Can you get a police escort? One asked.
No, the police don't care. They have their own problems. It's a city, you know.
We've started carrying billy clubs. They won't let us carry guns. A few of the guys carry motorcycle chains. They wear them like necklaces. A punk with a knife is no match for one of us swinging a motorcycle chain. I let them digest that for a moment. They would see their local trash man in a whole new light after that. They looked horrified, but they couldn't help themselves. I was not your usual faculty party entertainment.
What do your parents think of your new career?
They wanted me to go to medical school, but when I told them how much money my boss makes, they were impressed. He does a lot better than any doctor I know. So I guess they're proud of me.
How does your boss do so well?
Asked a bookish-looking fellow who had recently walked up.
Tips. We get tips everywhere we go.
I've never heard of that. Who gives a garbage man tips? I've never done that. The woman who was speaking sounded pretty sure of herself. No tips for her garbage man.
Well, if you're in the city and you don't want the dumpster to spill shit all over your steps when they pick it up, you tip the trash man. One of those dumpsters can do a lot of damage if it falls on a car. A well-tipped driver makes sure that doesn't happen. And if you've got a restaurant, you make sure you tip good. Otherwise, your trash overflows, you have trouble with rats, and the health inspector shuts you down.
Inspired by the appalled silence, I continued.
Did you read about that burger joint on Boston Road? Whole kitchen was full of rats. Little girl went in the bathroom and got bit. It was savage. Her arms were all chewed up, and just 9 years old. That place probably won't ever reopen. They didn't pay their sanitary engineer, and look what happened.
Excuse me, may I talk to you a second?
Said Annette. She and my mother had caught me entertaining their friends. They steered me away from the group. I moved toward the food table, picked up the shrimp platter, which had only 11 shrimp remaining on it, and began to eat. I was having a fine time.
John Elder, what are you going to do? You can't lead those people on like that. They believe you.
Well, you invited me. And they had. But they wouldn't do so again.
Hey, Annette, I've got a question for you. Which is easier to load on a garbage truck, a pile of bowling balls or a pile of dead babies?
I don't know, she said sullenly.
Dead babies. You can use a pitchfork.
My mother and Annette looked sick. They were both sorry they had invited me. I wasn't worried. I was sure Walter would see the whole thing as humorous. I ate the last shrimp.
I'll go apologize to your friends. You wait here.
I walked back to the group of garbage aficionados I had collected.
Folks, I'm sorry, but I've got to go. They just called from work. Emergency. One of the other garbage companies firebombed one of our trucks. They're calling all of us in. See you later.
And with that, I walked quickly to my motorcycle, put on my helmet and leather jacket, and kicked over the engine. The back wheels spun up little clumps of grass as I rode away, my crazy parents and their friends receding in the rearview mirror. Chapter 11. The Flaming Washtub. Visiting my friend Jim Boughton's house was another of my escapes. We had similar interests, Jim and I. Rocketry, high-powered electricity, explosives, motorcycles, fast cars. Jim lived about 5 miles away in South Amherst. He was 2 years older than me, blonde and heavy-set, with a slightly demented look. He lived in a big old Victorian home that was owned by Amherst College, where his parents taught theater. The house was ours to wreck.
"Don't worry," Jim would say, as debris spattered the outside of the house.
"Amherst College will fix it." The Amherst College maintenance staff mowed the lawn, repainted the interior, and fixed all of our destruction. My father taught at the university, which was low rent compared to Amherst. We didn't get a free house, and no one fixed anything. The holes I smashed in the doors at 13 were still there 3 years later.
"Come check out what I built," Jim called and said one day.
Jim had been working feverishly on a top-secret project, and it seemed he had finally gotten it to work. When I arrived at his house, he led me out to the shed, which stood about 50 feet behind his parents' house. Sitting in the middle of the floor was a burned-looking concrete barrel with a steel frame above it, from which a chain dropped into the barrel.
A hose connected the barrel to a huge silver tank of propane.
"That's my new furnace," he said proudly.
Another 18-year-old would have shown off his new car, or his new guitar, or his new camera. Jim showed off his new blast furnace. He had built the whole thing himself, right there in the shed. He had made the pliers and tongs and equipment to handle molten metal. He had made the frames to hold the ceramic furnace body. And he had made the burner. Amazingly, almost everything was constructed from scrap. I was sure there was nothing else like it in Amherst.
"You've got your very own steel mill," I said.
"No, it's not a steel mill. You need oxygen injection to get the higher temperatures needed for steel. This is a non-ferrous foundry for casting aluminum and bronze." I was a good audience. The average layperson would not have appreciated the distinction.
"Want to see it work?" he asked.
Without waiting for my agreement, he walked over and turned a switch. I heard the sound of a fan picking up speed.
"I've got two high-capacity vacuum cleaner blowers forcing air into the furnace. It's not as good as oxygen injection, but it's free."
The sound of the fans got louder as they sped up.
"I'm using the most powerful fans I could find at Granger's down in Springfield," Jim said.
Those fans could move air. Inside the garage, my hair was starting to blow.
"Now we turn on the propane and light it off!"
Jim turned what looked like a water faucet down low on the side of the machine. The smell of propane filled the garage.
"Ignition!"
He grinned, lit a ball of paper trash, and tossed it in the barrel. There was a loud bang, and I was stunned for a second. A bright flash, and the propane odor had vanished. If the shed had had windows, they would have blown out. But it didn't have windows, at least not since the first time the furnace had been fired up. Once lit, it sounded like a jet engine at idle. I looked over the top of the barrel and saw flames swirling in the chamber.
"Let's crank it up,"
he said, as if it wasn't cranked already. He turned a big rheostat, and the fan sped up as he turned the faucet to let more propane into the burner.
"We have to keep the propane mixture right," he said. "A yellow flame means carbon monoxide. We want an almost colorless blue flame."
The roar was increasing to the point where I needed earplugs. Blue flames came out the top of the barrel. The roar was incredible, unbearable. So was the heat.
"Let's melt some metal," he grinned.
We tossed chunks of scrap aluminum into a bucket, which I quickly discovered was not a bucket when Jim corrected me.
"It's a number 40 silicon carbide crucible. It holds 40 pounds of aluminum or 120 pounds of bronze. Molten, that is."
The aluminum chunks, former automobile transmissions, were about to liquefy. Wearing heavy gloves, Jim hooked the crucible to the chains and used a pole to move it over the furnace. Then he lowered the crucible inside. The sound of the furnace changed slightly as it swallowed the metal. After a few seconds, the chain that dropped down into the barrel was glowing dull red, just like the barrel top. I was afraid to step over and look inside, but I did anyway. It had only been a few moments, and already the hard edges of the broken metal were softening in the intense heat. His furnace looked like a jet engine running in a gardener's shed in South Amherst. I opened the door to get some air, but Jim motioned me to close it.
"The roar antagonizes the neighbors! They might call the police!"
The police had visited Jim and his inventions in the past. We certainly didn't need them there again. Jim pulled the chain, and the crucible came up out of the furnace, glowing hot. He pulled it on the track and gripped it with long metal tongs. He handed me some gloves and another pair of tongs.
"You can help me pour!"
I held the pouring shank, a long pole with a hoop in the middle that Jim had welded up in his garage workshop. Jim carefully set the crucible in the shank. He scooped the slag off the top, then slowly and smoothly poured the molten metal into a gray box on the floor. Steam jetted from the corners of the box as he poured. The box contained tightly packed damp sand. The object he wanted to mold in aluminum had been inserted into the damp sand and then carefully withdrawn. The process was surprisingly delicate.
"It'll take a few minutes for the metal to harden
and we can crack the mold open. He shut off the furnace. The fan spooled down, and the heat gradually diminished. Now that the noise was gone, he signaled that I could open the doors. We cracked the mold halves apart. There inside lay a perfectly formed pair of human arms cast in gray aluminum. I was impressed.
"They're Andy's," Jim said proudly.
Andy was his little brother. He had posed, if you can call it that, in Jim's sandbox while the arm molds were being made. Jim sprayed the arms with water, and steam filled the garage.
He lifted an arm. Look at the detail. Fingernails. Hair. Even fingerprints. He was right. The casting was remarkably detailed.
A few months later, Jim was working in the garage attached to his parents' house. It was a big house with a big garage, which Jim had turned into his private auto repair shop. Jim had taken a huge soapstone washtub from the basement and made it into a parts cleaning tank. He filled it with gasoline, which was flammable but very good for cleaning grease off old car parts. That night, Jim and I were helping our friend John and his girlfriend Carol rebuild their VW engine. The engine block and a pile of other parts were soaking in the tank as we stood around, tinkering and drinking beer. Jim had installed a pump in the washtub to circulate the gasoline. It cleaned better if it was moving, but we couldn't run the pump all the time because the vapors were dangerous, and cleaning is a slow process. The gas was getting dirty, I guess. We'd already gone through a whole case of old Milwaukee, and less than half the parts were clean. It was after 11, too late for more beer. We'd have to make do with what we had. Jim walked over to plug the pump in, and a spark jumped clean across the garage. In an instant, the tub of gasoline was on fire. It seemed like the whole place was on fire. With all the fumes, it probably was.
Fuck! Fire! Get out! Now, run!
I was close to the door, so I jumped out, leaving my beer behind. All of a sudden, the 75-degree night air felt cold. I didn't seem to be on fire, and I didn't feel damaged. I was lucky, I guess. Everyone scattered through the open door into the safety of the yard. Everyone but Jim. We could see him in the flame-filled garage. His arm was on fire. He took off his glove and swatted it, and the fire went out. In only a matter of seconds, flames from the tub were hitting the garage ceiling. Yet Jim was still in there. He moved to the flaming tub, crouched low. With a mighty shove, he pushed the tub of burning gas and car parts out the door and into the driveway. It came to rest about 20 feet away. Jim was hardly burned at all. He was grinning, proud. He had saved the house. He took off his gloves, looked at each arm, and nodded approvingly.
No damage, he grinned.
In the heat of the burning garage, he had actually thought clearly enough to put on heavy gloves so that he could push the tub without destroying his hands. Remarkable.
Good thing that tub was on wheels, Jim said.
It was good. Otherwise, the whole huge house would have burned to the ground. Carol emerged from the house. I hadn't seen her go in, but then a lot was happening.
I called the fire department, she said. They're on the way.
Jim wasn't too happy to hear that.
Why did you call them?
He asked, as flames from the burning tub reached 20 feet into the sky. Truthfully, at that point it was harmless. It would have burned itself out in an hour or so and provided entertainment. Jim, John, and I preferred not to involve the authorities in anything, for any reason. Two of us ran alongside the house and unreeled the garden hoses. There were two, more than enough, we figured, to wet down the surrounding area till the gas burned out. The flames went out in the garage as Jim trained one of the hoses on the ceiling and on a few burning scraps on the floor. Outside, however, the flames were roaring. The gasoline was burning fiercely, making a pyre higher than the roof of the house. Paint had started to bubble on the wall nearest the flames.
I wish I'd pushed it a little farther away, Jim said.
It was way too hot to approach by then. I looked at the scene and concluded the house was not in any real danger. Nothing fresh paint wouldn't fix. At that moment, Jim's parents emerged. They had been reading at the other end of the house. They appeared calm. Jim's mother was smoking a cigar, and his father had a drink in his hand. They looked at us, the fire, and each other. Without a word, they went back inside. Moments later, the fire department arrived. We were all standing back at least 20 feet because of the intense heat. Jim and I were regretting the loss of our engines, which would surely be nothing but slag when the fire cooled. The fire department was ready to show its prowess. 4 men ran down the driveway dragging a fire hose. Jim attempted to stop them.
"I don't think you want to do that. That tub contains gasoline and magnesium. You need foam, not water."
"We know what we're doing, son. Step out of the way."
"No, I'm telling you. Water is dangerous on a magnesium fire. You need foam."
"Step aside."
The voice of authority spoke. And with that, 2 men held the hose and blasted the tub. There was a violent explosion as the water hit the burning magnesium, and the water broke down into its component parts, hydrogen and oxygen. The magnesium and gasoline exploded and rained down over the yard. We ran for cover. Balls of magnesium, burning with a brilliant blue-white flame, were everywhere. The firefighters looked stunned. For some of them, the Vietnam veterans, it must have been like being back in combat, right in Jim's backyard.
"God damn it, I warned you guys! Now look what you've done!"
It was a scene from hell. Chunks of burning magnesium had scattered everywhere from the blast. Some were eating holes in the van parked in the driveway. Some were burning on the roof of the house. Several seemed to be eating flaming holes through the driveway itself. Multiple fires were burning, many with the distinct white-hot glow of burning metal. The firefighters retreated to their truck, where it turned out they did carry foam. Now they had some real work to do. They had sneered at foam before, but not now. Jim politely reminded them it was their fault.
"You should have listened to me. Look at the mess you assholes made."
They mixed the foam and, much more cautiously this time, approached the fires. Even the foam was slow to extinguish them. They would spray a spot, and it would seem to be out, then explode again a minute later. It was scary, this mess the fire department had made. Jim realized the root of their problem was lack of knowledge.
"In a university town, you guys should be trained on chemical fires."
They did not respond. 2 firemen approached the tub with pikes, the sorts of tools they used to break down doors. They knocked the burning tub over, presumably to let their buddy spray foam inside. They seemed to have forgotten Jim's warning.
"Stupid assholes, it's still full of gas!"
Now the yard, which had so far escaped destruction, was on fire too. At least the scene was well lit. 2 more fire trucks showed, and the chief arrived by car. A crowd had gathered. Jim's parents had come back out, and now they stood off to the side speaking softly to each other. His dad had finished his drink, and his mom was enjoying the last of her cigar by firelight. Their calm was remarkable. It took the fire department over an hour to extinguish the blaze. When everything was out, and the night was once again dark, the chief had a long talk with Jim. There were calls for his arrest from some of the firefighters, but really there were no grounds. The chief could only threaten to return for periodic inspections of the house. Later on, that night would seem like the calm before the storm, as my family and my life completely fell to pieces. Little Bear told me she never wanted to speak to me again, and she wouldn't even tell me why. I was crushed. She wouldn't come to the phone and wouldn't see me. I didn't know what to do. I was so lonely. 2 years would pass before I learned why she'd left. On top of that, my parents finally separated. Varmint stayed with my mother, who moved to an apartment in town. Then, a few months later, my father moved to an apartment and my mother and Varmint returned to the house.
The dog and I remained at the house through all of that, except for periodic forays into the woods. Now that my parents had split, my mother decided she was bisexual. She took up with a woman her own age for a while, but then she got involved with a woman a year younger than me. It was unsettling, the idea that my mother would leave my father for a girl. But when her great love turned out to be even younger than me, that was just too weird. Meanwhile, my father was struggling in his apartment in town, at one point eating sleeping pills in a drunken suicide attempt that left him drying out in the hospital. We were lucky his colleagues liked him and the university was tolerant. And I guess it's hard to fire a professor with tenure. He had stopped going to Dr. Finch, saying, "He has crazy ideas, son. I don't know what will happen with the doctor and your mother." Despite the good things the doctor had accomplished for me, I, too, was troubled. Things just didn't seem right over there. I had gone to see doctors of one sort or another all my life. Their waiting rooms were places where other people actually waited. Patients flowed in and out. Their offices were always nice and clean. They looked, well, professional. Dr. Finch's office was nothing of the sort. It was old, and the furniture was run down and threadbare. I never saw new faces there, just the same hangers-on. Patients, he said, that I'd seen for years. Most of the time, the office was deserted except for Hope, the doctor, and us. It didn't look like any other medical office I'd ever seen. "The doctor is unique," my mother would say.
"The doctor is crazy," was my grandfather's response.
Friends from town would say things like, "I hear that Finch is a nutcase." Even though the doctor had done good things for me, it was hard to maintain my confidence in the face of those remarks, especially when I began hearing them everywhere. Dr. Finch grew a long white beard and wore a Santa hat in the middle of summer, which was not exactly reassuring. I learned he'd been fired from the state hospital before we'd met him. Hearing that, I thought of my grandfather's "run out of Kingsport, Tennessee" comment a few years back. Then I heard he was not even allowed in the local hospital. Can that be true? What did he do? I wondered. Dr. Finch's strange behavior proved to be too much for my father and me. Both of us stopped going to see him. Not my mother, though. She believed in the doctor for 6 more years, right up until the day she escaped. And she dragged the varmint along for a ride that got wilder and wilder as the doctor loaded her up on medications. Luckily for me, most of the shocking scenes that played out in front of my brother, described in his memoir Running with Scissors, were still a few years in the future, and by the time they occurred, I was well out of the doctor's orbit. It was not until 1983 that my mother finally broke free. When she did, all the vague worries I had ever felt about Dr. Finch became concrete. My mother went to the DA, saying the doctor had medicated her and then sexually assaulted her at a motel. At the same time, DA investigators discovered that Dr. Finch had billed my father's health insurance for many non-existent office visits. My mother was too upset to follow through with the sexual assault prosecution. She just wanted to escape. So the DA filed larceny charges over the bogus billing. That allowed them to get a restraining order against Dr. Finch and protect my mother as a state witness. Even then, Dr. Finch tried to silence my mother by having her committed against her will. Knowing all this, I was not surprised when the doctor's medical license was revoked in 1986. By then, I was long gone. It was music that took me from that insanity to a much better place. I was building a reputation among local musicians, and they welcomed me with open arms. Friday nights, I stepped from the madhouse that my family had become into the Rusty Nail, a local night spot. Now that I was an insider, I didn't have to worry about sneaking in or getting carded. I'd even grown a beard to look older. The bouncer and the cop actually greeted me at the door as they waved me inside. As I walked into the room, the lead singer of a local band named Fat stepped up to the microphone.
"This is rock and roll, people!"
He shouted it so loud, I saw the lights dim and felt my ears bleed. A palpable wave of energy rolled over the crowd, packed shoulder to shoulder.
1975!
When they launched into King of the Highway, I was transported into my own world. I was so lucky I had the music to take me there. I wish I could have brought the varmint along, but I was just a kid myself in grown-up clothes. He would be on his own. Chapter 12. I'm in prison with the band. It was Fat that saved me. Ever since I had dropped out of high school, I had been keeping their sound equipment going, and I had become friends with Dickie Marsh, the sound man, and Steve Ross, his assistant. Dickie was impressed that I had developed the ability to listen to the sound and tell him what knobs to trim on the graphic equalizer. He thought it was a natural gift, but it was really something I'd worked very hard at for several years. After one show, Peter Newland, the lead singer and flute player, came to talk to me.
"You could move in with us and do music all the time," he said. "We could even pay you $80 a week."
With that, I joined Fat and had a home. The band members lived together in an old farmhouse in Ashfield, up in the Berkshires. Billy Perry, the drummer, was across the hall from me. His drum practice ensured I'd never sleep too late. The rooms at the top of the stairs housed Mike Benson and Chris Newland, the band's two guitar players. Peter, Chris's brother, and the band's leader lived in the master bedroom up front. Dickie and Steve were squeezed in on the top floor. I moved my stuff into an empty room in the back corner of the ground floor and parked my motorcycle in the backyard right next to my window. Outside of time spent living in the woods as a feral child, this was the first time I had actually lived away from my family. With my own motorcycle, a place to live, and a role in a top band, I felt I had made it. To celebrate, I bought a Tektronix 504 oscilloscope, which became my pride and joy. I spent my days working on the sound equipment in a quest to squeeze every last watt of power out of the amps and get the very best possible sound from all the instruments. Fat became known for its sound as well as the quality of its music. Steve, Dickie, and I took turns driving the truck to shows and lugging the equipment in and out. It was a great life. Fat was one of a small number of bands that played its own music in clubs all over New England. Our manager also got us jobs opening for bigger bands at large concerts in Boston. That winter, we played with James Montgomery, James Cotton, Roxy Music, and Black Sabbath. The time I spent with them allowed me to meet other musicians, and I got more calls to design things, from more powerful amps to an electric flute. Old friends like Jim Boughton would come to my shows, but for the most part, I was on my own, with a new circle of people around me. I was getting pretty good at adapting to new people and places. I was even starting to see the world. Every time I had a day off, I took a trip somewhere on my motorcycle. I rode into Vermont, New Hampshire, anywhere I could go in a day's ride. That April, while the ground in Ashfield was still covered with 2 feet of snow, the band decided to take a trip to a Caribbean island, and I was included. They had saved up for this vacation, setting aside a few $100 from every show. Personally, my entire net worth was the $80 in my wallet when I left home, but Peter told me this would be an all-expenses-paid vacation. We flew from a dreary winter in western Massachusetts to Montserrat, a tropical paradise, where I would realize that I was kind of different from the typical rock and roll musician.